Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Steidl v. Furnan. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honors, this case is before you on an interlocutory appeal pursuant to the collateral order doctrine. The defendants filed a motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity below. The motion was granted as to count one, which was the Fourth Amendment claim, but was denied as to counts two, which was the Brady claim, and count three, which was the access to court case or claim. The issue before you today is purely one of law, and that's whether these police administrators, who were not involved in the investigation, the initial investigation, or the prosecution of Mr. Steidl, had a constitutional duty under Brady to come forward and disclose exculpatory evidence, allegedly exculpatory evidence, after Mr. Steidl had been convicted and had his convictions affirmed on direct appeal, and then had most of his post-appeal processes denied as well.
But Mr. Johnson, that's where I want to start, because you agree that he wasn't finished with the post-conviction proceedings when the knowledge came to the attention of your clients, right?
Yes.
Okay, just in terms of timing. And if it's really a question of law that we have that doesn't depend at all on any of the facts of this case, which obviously is important to our jurisdiction, I'm just wondering how far you would take this. So suppose, for example, not your case, but suppose, for example, it turned out that a videotape came into the possession of the police officer showing that it clearly was another person who committed this crime, and post-conviction proceedings are still going on. Your position has to be that the police officers have no duty whatsoever to alert the post-conviction court to this definitive exculpatory evidence.
The police officers would have no constitutional duty to come forward.
So they can just sit on it, in your opinion, and leave this man in prison, even though they have, in my hypothetical,
right, in your
of
hypothetical,
course,
right.
They have definitive exculpatory evidence.
Yes, and to some extent, Your Honor, that's based upon the weighing of the exculpatory evidence.
But it can't be if it's a question of law, because then you're into the facts.
Right, and we obviously can't argue that, because then the court wouldn't have jurisdiction. But there, if there were a duty to come forward in your hypothetical with the videotape, that duty is going to have to be created by the court, either as an extension of Brady or found somewhere in the due process clause.
That's where I guess the cases that you didn't discuss as much as I thought you might have are the line of cases from the Supreme Court of the United States, well predating these events, that essentially hold that the state is a unit. I'm thinking in particular of Kyles against Whitley, where the court holds that it doesn't really matter if the police don't tell the prosecutor doesn't tell the police, the state is the one with the obligation to come forward with exculpatory evidence. And the court thought this so obvious just this last term that it issues a per curiam opinion in the Youngblood against West Virginia, reiterating this proposition.
And that's a good point, Your Honor. But I think the difference is that in the criminal context, either in a prosecution or post-conviction, in that setting, the court looks at the state as a unitary body. But under the law of 1983, it's based upon individual actions, and the state is not looked at as a unitary system. It's looked at to the individual's particular actions that they did or did
well,
not.
Now we have a 1983 case, but back when the duty to come forward would have arisen, it was precisely the criminal context you're talking about. It was post-conviction proceedings related to the criminal conviction. So it sounds to me like you're admitting that they do, in fact, have this unitary, the state character to them, and they should have come forward.
I don't think there is a duty under those circumstances that would impose liability on these individuals for their actions.
But if the duty to come forward with the exculpatory evidence existed and was well established, thanks to Kyles, thanks to Brady, thanks to, you know, the liberty interests, you know, the state is not supposed to keep innocent people behind bars, obviously. That's just a general due process liberty interest. I don't see why that doesn't pretty much establish that there was, in fact, the kind of duty that you are challenging. I find it a little bit shocking to think, at least in my hypothetical, that the police with impunity can simply refuse to turn over fully exculpatory evidence.
Well, and I guess one of the questions would be, turn it over to who? I think this court's been very clear that the duty is to turn it over to the prosecutors who then turn it
right,
over.
Right, but then the prosecutors, I mean, we presume right. The prosecutor would comply with his
correct.
Or her duties under the law. I don't think there's any reason to assume that they wouldn't. So had the police turned this over to the prosecutor, it would have come to the attention of the court and of the defendant in the appropriate way.
Well, Your Honor, the reason why we're focusing on Brady is because that's the claim that they presented below. They argued at least six times in the brief below that this was a Brady claim. And they specifically alleged that in the brief below, that they're saying this is a Brady claim. So our focus was on Brady, and Brady clearly is a trial right.
Well, you say clearly, except then the Supreme... I know you distinguish it, but the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania against Ritchie does make this remark about the duty to disclose exculpatory material is ongoing.
Yes.
It seems to me as long... There's one thing that... Another thing that strikes me as a limiting factor that may be something that's concerning you, but at least in this court, we've drawn a very careful line between exculpatory evidence actually in the possession of the police, which, of course, does have to be turned over, and exculpatory evidence that the police might have found had they only gone out and investigated further, which we say there's no such duty to do that. If they
right.
have it, then that's one thing. But if they don't have it, they don't have it.
Right.
So I'm not sure it's quite so open-ended as you're concerned about.
Well, if I could address Pennsylvania versus Ritchie for a minute, there is that clause. It's not even a sentence in that opinion. There's a clause that says basically the duty is to disclose is ongoing. But that clause needs to be read in the context of the sentence that it's in the context of the paragraph that sentence is in, and in the context of what that case is about. That case is clearly about trial rights. That case involved CYS documents, Children and Youth Services, basically their version of DCFS, documents that were found to be confidential statutorily. And the issue was whether or not at trial or before trial defense counsel could get at those. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said the defense counsel has the right to basically go and dig through those. The Supreme Court says no, the district court can look at the documents, the circuit court can look at the documents, and determine what's exculpatory and what isn't exculpatory. So it was in the context of a trial setting, and if you actually read, when you read the sentence, or you read the paragraph, the first sentence of that paragraph says, we find that Ritchie's interest, as well as that of the Commonwealth, in ensuring a fair trial can be protected by fully requiring that the CYS files be submitted only to the trial court for in-camera review. And then, the key sentence, the court goes on to say, moreover, the duty to disclose is ongoing. Semicolon. They don't stop there. They said the duty to disclose is ongoing. Information that may be deemed immaterial upon the original examination may become important as the proceedings progress. And the court would be obligated to release the information material to the fairness of the trial. So clearly that's a trial case, and that's why it doesn't apply in the cases.
Isn't a post-conviction proceeding all about whether the trial was a fair trial? It's not like the trial drops out of the picture. I mean, you know, we're looking at the trial at that point, whether it's a state post-conviction proceeding or a federal habeas proceeding. And so your position has to be that the police can withhold required evidence when they learn that the trial was, in fact, not a fair proceeding, whether it's DNA evidence, whether it's my videotape, whether it's anything else that might be exculpatory, and in a sense trick the court into thinking that the trial came up with a reliable result when they know, in fact, that it did not.
Well, it's in your hypothetical, and depending on the circumstances, it depends on who's doing the tricking. For example, investigators, police officers who are involved in the investigation, clearly are in a different situation, just as prosecutors are, than the defendants here.
But we're assuming the defendants here know, as of the time of the post-conviction proceeding, that an unreliable result may have been reached. Because they now have the Callahan report. I mean, they know what they know at this point, and you're saying they have a privilege not to tell the prosecutor, who then will not tell anybody else.
Well, it's not that they have a privilege, but
yes, they do. If they don't have to disclose it,
maybe it's just a flip side. I was going to say they don't have a constitutional duty to come forward with that information and go to the post-trial prosecutor. The concern is, if they're not involved, what are they going to do with the evidence? How are they going to evaluate it? Do they immediately have to go to the prosecutor? As the complaint specifically alleges, the Callahan memo, the first one, is in May of 2000. Well, and then he was allowed to continue all the way up until August 2001. So clearly Callahan is still working along the way.
But that strikes me as a fact-specific point, because in your case, your client's case, there are probably still remaining questions about whether what Callahan had turned up with was sufficiently exculpatory, et cetera. I mean, you know, sometimes there, as you well know, in, you know, Brady cases, was it really material, was it really exculpatory, could be factual issues. But since this is a legal question we have before us, you've staked your ground on just the absolute, we can know everything exculpatory in the world and we can still sit there and keep quiet. If we so choose to do, we can sit there and keep quiet because there's no duty to disclose. That's your argument.
I see that my...
That's your rebuttal time, yes. So you're certainly entitled
sure.
to keep it
yes.
if you want.
Our position is that these officers in this circumstances at the time certainly didn't have a fair warning as to what the law was. We've cited cases from the Third Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Northern District of Illinois, the Northern District of Texas, two district courts in New York, all saying there is no constitutional duty to come forward with this information. And we've cited two law review articles where you'd think somebody who sits down and takes the time to analyze an issue, and then they both, two independent authors, come up with the view, this is unclear. One says courts are all over the board. The other author says this is unclear, and the authority that's cited is superficial at best. A police officer in that position should not be held liable for choosing the wrong side of the debate. If judges around the country are saying there is no right, why do five officers sitting in Springfield have to guess right upon pain of liability? So with that,
yes,
sir?
Do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, with that, I'll sit down and save the rest of my time. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Taylor?
Your Honors, if it please the Court. Personally, and on behalf of the plaintiff, Steidel, I'd much prefer to rely on the U.S. Supreme Court in Brady versus Maryland, in U.S. v. Augers, in Ray Winship, and in Ritchie, and, in, of course, in Kyle, than I would on a law review article or on a statement in an Illinois bar journal that says that the law is not clearly settled.
But, Mr. Taylor, I mean, that's where I would like you to start, because even if we were to conclude that the first of the two inquiries under Saucier against Katz was satisfied in your favor, namely that there should have been disclosure under these circumstances, with the state post-conviction proceedings still pending and the amount of knowledge they had and so on, there's the second inquiry. And as mm-hmm. your opponent just said, Mr. Johnson just said, if courts all over the country are coming up with different answers, then what the Supreme Court envisioned anyway in Saucier against Katz was that the law would go forward if one were to find that the right is there, but you're not going to do it on the backs of these particular people. It's not fair to impose damages on them?
Well, I think there's two answers to the question of whether the right is clearly established, and under Saussure and under Hope. And the first is the way that the court itself decided below. The court below decided that what that was alleged by the plaintiff was so egregious that it fit the Smith versus City of Chicago standard here. And perhaps it would be good to review not a hypothetical, but in fact what is alleged and what the court found in its opinion with regard to what these particular defendants did and didn't do.
Would you draw the line between evidence that is conclusive as to innocence as opposed to any other exculpatory evidence? You know, there's a whole bunch of things that fall under Brady.
Well,
inconsistent statements of a witness and that sort of stuff. But here you have actual innocence, apparently conclusively.
Well, that's certainly
by Callahan in his report.
Yes.
So would you draw the line there on how far you'd extend?
Well, I really don't have to draw the line because we have the actual innocent situation here. Yes, Callahan not only found that that these men were innocent, particularly the plaintiff here, but he also found previous misconduct on behalf of those individuals, particularly Eckerty, who worked in his own agency at the time of the original investigation, and that there was also, he found evidence that there was a decision made by that prior ISP official along with the other prosecuting and investigating officers to not record or turn over, quote, negative information. So what we had was him finding new evidence of a patent Brady violation in the original trial by the original officers, including one of his own officers. And we also have, in this particular case, him developing strong evidence of another suspect. Another suspect who had a motive, who had opportunity, who was there at the scene, who later tried to bribe witnesses with $25,000. It goes on and on. Who was involved in a criminal conspiracy. All of those things. We're talking about a very, very flagrant situation, as the court pointed out. We're not talking about a piece of impeachment. We're talking about innocence. And we're talking about a law enforcement official, a lieutenant in the ISP, saying not only did these men not found guilty by beyond a reasonable doubt, but they were innocent. So, in fact, the court, when the court looked at it, and this isn't my language, but I think it's important to quote it because the court, in determining egregiousness, relied on this language that he said. He said that these law enforcement officials conspired to bury the truth. So then when we're looking at the egregiousness of the conduct, we're not only looking at the nature of what was suppressed, the innocence, the fact of another suspect, the fact that one of their own people previously, along with the other defendants, decided no negative evidence should be turned over. No negative evidence should be recorded. That's right in the Callahan memos, the earliest ones. So we're talking about that, and we're not just talking about them sitting back after that. That's bad enough, Your Honors, for them to say, oh, well, we're not going to turn this over. We're not going to take it to the prosecutor. And we found out last night in a letter from defense counsel that, in fact, the whole argument, basically, that they made in their reply brief, that we hadn't alleged that they withheld it from the prosecutors, was, in fact, not true. Because we had repeatedly alleged, and the facts show, that they withheld it from the prosecutors, not just from the court, not just from the governor, but from the prosecutors, the ones that they are, under the law, supposed to, under Kyle and under Jones versus City of Chicago, here in this very jurisdiction, are supposed to bring the evidence to and not to deceive.
But let me follow up a little bit on what Judge Evans was asking, because if we're at the second inquiry under Saussure, and it's the clearly established business. Mm-hmm. If you were just talking about some piece of impeachment evidence, which would certainly be Brady material at the trial, maybe it's not so clear once the trial is all over, and maybe there was lots and lots of other impeachment evidence or the like. You might think it was cumulative. You might think all sorts of things. You might not have any idea about that. And yet you would have to say, I guess your argument is that actual evidence of innocence, very strong evidence of innocence, is different. Well, that suggests to me that you're not really quite making a pure Brady argument. You're making kind of a Brady plus, you know, a fundamental liberty interest kind of argument.
Well, Brady is premised on a fundamental due process. If you look at Brady and you look at Augers and you look at the cases that come before, they look backwards to In re Winship and they look at that fundamental concept. Why is it that you have to turn this evidence over? You have to turn it over because of that fundamental due process right to protect the innocent, to make sure that the criminal justice system, to quote some of those cases, and I can't verbatim, but I know them generally, that in general, it protects the integrity of the criminal justice system. It protects the innocent, the right not to be convicted if you're innocent. Really, that's the fundamental due process. So it kind of merges. Yes, it is a more fundamental due process interest, but Brady kind of exemplifies it in the context that we're talking about. And the context we're talking about it in is, of course, in the context of, do you have to turn it over? What do you do with it when you get it? And the point I wanted to make was that these individuals who are law enforcement officials, what do? Day in and day out, they investigate. Why do they investigate? To bring evidence for prosecution. So to say that investigators, particularly supervisory investigators, don't understand and reasonably wouldn't understand that if they're sitting on evidence of innocence, that because it's after the trial rather than before the trial, they're not on notice that they're supposed to produce it? Shocks me.
How long does this duty last, in your view? Suppose the post-conviction proceedings were all over, even federal habeas corpus was all over, and now somebody goes back, you know, somebody like the, you know, the Innocence Project or someone goes back and actually figures out that this was an innocent man and somebody comes along and is trying to get a second or successive petition for habeas corpus. Is this a perpetual obligation in your view?
I think it should be, but I don't think that this court has to reach that issue because unlike what opposing counsel said, you know, that the law is all over the place. In fact, there's a clear line of cases coming from Brady on down saying that in post-conviction matters, there's the Ninth Circuit case, a Tenth Circuit case, I believe a Fifth Circuit case, an Eleventh Circuit case, all of which recognize a post-conviction, whether it be in habeas, whether it be in post-conviction, whether it be on appeal, right in this circuit. In a different context, we have Houston versus Partee. Now, if I am a reasonable law officer, even though Houston versus Partee dealt with prosecutors, if I read that case or I was told about that case, I would think I had to turn it over post-conviction. Because what did this court do to those prosecutors in that case? It referred them to the ARDC because they sat on some evidence of innocence. Now, is a reasonable law officer going to think, if he were informed of Houston, well, because I'm a police officer and not a prosecutor, I'm not supposed to do that? I don't see that. I mean, this really, in terms of reasonableness, in terms of the idea of egregiousness, in terms of the idea that, in fact, a reasonable person would understand or that this was a constitutional violation, I think it's basically, it's very, very compelling. And that's how the court decided the issue. But he could also look at the line of cases. And because this court in Cleveland versus Purdue has said that if you look at other circuits, if you don't have it here, and if you look at the other circuits and you look at Houston, you could say it's very close to having at least closely analogous cases. So when you've got the egregiousness and the cases, you've got two ways. The court could have done it either way, and when you put them together, I think there's no question, Your Honors, but that a reasonable law enforcement official in these circumstances would have to have known under the law and under the Constitution he should have turned this evidence over.
Mr. Taylor, are you making any distinction between a prosecutor's capacity to weigh evidence and a law enforcement agent's capacity to weigh evidence?
Well, it's different, and I think that a law enforcement officer, I think he's supposed to turn it all over.
He's making an assessment, too. I mean, when you say turn it over, he's turning over something that you feel it's important and essential that he turn over. So let me give you just this possible hypothetical. That is, within the critical agency, not a sheriff's department, but the main investigating agency, let's say ISP here, you have a member of that agency who comes upon information that suggests, which would speak to innocence if this was the critical witness, that this person has a history, a terrible history of either lying or been found wanting in other prosecutions, but didn't speak to the specifics of whether that individual committed this heinous crime. Is that the kind of thing that also, if he fails to bring it forward to, let's say, the main investigator in that case, would subject him to a 1983 lawsuit?
Well, that's a closer question, obviously, than the one we have here, because we have another suspect, and there's not a question of credibility. We're not arguing that the credibility questions that Callahan talked about necessarily needed to be turned over, and some of those we already knew. We're talking about the substantive stuff, the other suspect, the fact that there was clearly he found to be a prior Brady violation by officials that were integrally involved in the initial investigation. I suppose there are questions which would ultimately be questions of fact, I guess, as to whether if one law enforcement officer discounted some information, therefore didn't turn it over. Then we might get into an argument, well, maybe he should have turned it over. And in fact, it turned out to be exculpatory. But that's the thing about why you turn it over, because defense counsel can better understand, even in an impeachment circumstance, why a line in a document that so-and-so that he would understand might be a witness that he'd want to use to impeach the case. Police officers might not notice that. That's true.
The investigating agency in a high-profile case receives a series of calls indicating I did it, you know, the false claim of
yes.
perpetration of the crime. Should they all be recorded, not discounted, and a failure to report the 10 people that confessed apart from the person indicted, so that the defense counsel can weigh those names, examine those names.
That's another case, Judge, as you probably remember. That's the Street Files case that this court had much experience with in the 80s. Yes, ultimately it got decided through litigation, through the Jones case, and through the police department's own regulations. Yes, you write everything down. Now they have the GPRs that they have to write everything down so that they're not making a determination on the fly about whether one of those 10 people who came in and supposedly falsely confessed might not be falsely confessing. And then defense lawyer, if he wants to and be that thorough, he can go and call all 10 of them and try to figure out.
But that's really not our case.
I'm sorry.
That's not our case. Not at all.
So
this is an investigation by Callahan, a thorough investigation, and a conclusion that blows up the whole state's case.
Definitely. And it's told to these people. So when they're looking at the evidence, knowing that one of their best investigators, a lieutenant, says that these men are innocent. So I think that's really the crusher right there. Thank you very much. I see my time
is up. Actually, you have another minute if you want, Mr. Taylor.
You're
not constitutionally mandated to use it.
Just say, for all the above stated reasons, we certainly urge the court to affirm the decision of Judge Baker below. Thank you,
Mr. Taylor. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honors. I understand why my friend, Mr. Taylor, doesn't like the cases I cite, because they go against him. And this court may not like the litany of cases we've cited, and this court may decide that the cases we've cited and we rely on that specifically hold that there is not a Brady right or a due process right.
Let me ask you this. Judge Wood had asked about successive habeas petitions and that sort of thing. There is an exception to filing multiple successive attacks, but there's the exception is for actual innocence claims. So if that exception holds for the timeliness or the jurisdictional ability of a court to consider a claim of actual innocence, why wouldn't actual innocence unearthed at some time by a responsible law enforcement officer be required to be announced to the other side this is an egregious case. I think this guy's in prison for on death row, he could have been executed during.
He never made an actual innocence argument at any point, and he was released on habeas corpus.
Well, he didn't have the evidence to do it. I'm sure he was defending himself. He put the state to its proof.
And he did have some of the evidence, and we've established that they had.
Well, he didn't know that there was a second suspect who was some Republican contributor to somebody. I hate to mention a partisan political issue into this case, but that's present here.
And
he didn't know any of that stuff.
Well, it's outside the pleadings, Your Honor, but the Callahan memo contains numerous statements of fact, statements of opinion, many of which are incorporated in the complaint, which he obtained from their own investigator, Bill Clutter. Obviously, we can't argue that on appeal, and there's a lot of factual issues that we can't go into, but it's not that cut and dry. And what our real point is, and I see my time's up, it's a legal issue. Under these facts, and I understand why they're arguing the facts, but it's a legal issue on when you need to disclose. And there's numerous cases saying you don't need to disclose post-conviction. And this court can do what it needs to do and fashion a law going forward, but it can't do it on the backs of these individuals. We'd ask that the district court's orders be reversed, that judgment be entered on the three federal counts, and that the state law supplemental cases claims be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Johnson, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.